IVT Network is proud to present the Compounding Pharmacy Compliance Conference, a virtual event with something for all. Compounders continue to face extreme scrutiny while navigating an evolving regulatory landscape, changing roles and responsibilities of drug compounders, as well as the continued impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. So, this Compounding Pharmacy Compliance Conference comes at an extremely relevant time. Registration is now open for the industry's leading conference for compounding professionals, providing the necessary tools and tactics to strengthen compounding systems and processes. Attendees of this acclaimed virtual event will take part in 2 days of live sessions featuring interactive content, packed with key insights on the evolving regulatory landscape, gaps in FDA guidance, and opportunities for clarity, techniques, and best practices to ensure accuracy and sterility in drug compounding. There will be actionable procedures and tools to embrace organizational change and efficiency resources and the role of automation in the future of drug compounding. Plus, pharmacists can earn up to 11 ACPE credits. Visit informaconnect.com/compounding-pharmacy-compliance for all the details on agenda, registration, and special group rates for teams.
This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Thank you, and welcome to another episode of Voices in Validation, brought to you by the IVT Network. This week, we bring you Risk Revolution, a monthly series that with the goal of advancing the maturity of risk management practices within the industry by covering topics that challenge quality professionals to seek opportunities to improve and advance the ways in which they perceive and manage risk. This week, our series coordinators, Lori and Nula, have broken ranks and jumped sectors to the commercial nuclear industry to invite their guest, Rob Della Espriella, to share his insights and expertise on the need for critical thinking and complex problem-solving skills in getting to the root of the matter when we investigate, correct, and prevent failures. So welcome, Rob. Welcome, Lori. Welcome, Nula. It's great to have you all.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Hi, Stacy. Yeah. Listen, it's great to be back with you again, Stacy, and we're always delighted to be here, but we're particularly happy to have Rob with us today to help revolutionize the way we practice risk management within our industry. And really, it's, you know, through applying learnings from other highly regulated critical sector like the commercial nuclear industry. And, you know, across our life science sector, ineffective root cause identification and analysis continues to undermine, you know, many organizations' best efforts to eliminate failures and deviations. And unfortunately, it continues to be a regular feature of the regulator observations that we see in 483s and warning letters and non-conformance reports. So, you know, with that in mind, we thought that it was time to have this talk about the skills of critical thinking and complex problem solving. And I guess, you know, for us, they really lie at the heart of an effective risk management or risk-based decision making, which we've been, you know, talking about for the past couple of episodes. But unfortunately, we still don't see widespread competency development in these areas of critical thinking and complex problem solving across our sector. And still too much of the training and education in QRM remains, you know, narrowly focused on QA or QRM roles and equally focused around the kind of the regulatory ICH Q9 or ICH 14971 requirements. And at worst, are often just tools-based. So today's discussion is a topic really close to my heart. And I know that that resonates for you too, Lori, I think.
Oh, yes, 100%. So first of all, I want to thank Rob for joining us. And I read your background, Rob, and I was just really excited to do this podcast. I think it's much needed. And I totally agree with you, Nula. I think in terms of the critical thinking and complex problem solving, I think that's something that just recently I'm starting to see a little bit more discussion around in the pharma industry. In fact, I actually did a talk recently on a critical thinking aspect, and I'll be doing one later this year as well. But it's something that I just think we're barely scratching the surface on. So I greatly appreciate having you here today, Rob. And just to kind of recap for the listeners, the last couple of episodes, we've really delved into decision making and really focused a lot around the bias and human heuristics piece of it. So I think diving into the critical and complex problem solving is a great segue into our discussion today. But before we get started, I think it'd be useful, Rob, if you could give us a little bit more background around the history of root cause analysis, especially with the emphasis in the commercial nuclear industry, and how this has become such a central piece of your risk management program.
Well, absolutely. And first, thank you, Lori and Nuala and Stacy, for having me here today. I was really looking forward to this for quite a few days, ever since Nuala invited me to come on your show. So excited to be here. And yes, I would love to bring you some of the latest and greatest from the commercial nuclear side. And by way of history, I wanted to start with just a little bit of a background on some of the events in commercial nuclear that almost shut down the entire industry. In fact, some of these events have actually caused complete policy changes in countries like Germany and Spain. And I think you recognize some of these really famous ones. Three Mile Island in 1979, and Chernobyl in 1986, and Fukushima Daiichi in 2011. In fact, I was on National Public Radio talking about the Fukushima incident a while back. So these events were really big deals, and there have been many others in commercial nuclear as well. One of the huge things that came out of this historically was after Three Mile Island in 79, we were almost shut down by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so the commercial sites got together and pulled a regulatory body called the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. And INPO became our own self-regulating body, much like the NRC, only a little tougher, more stringent. And we inspect every site. INPO inspects every site in the United States every 2 years. So they continually are inspecting and raising the bar and sharing lessons learned, because we know that we're only as strong as our weakest link in commercial nuclear. One reactor meltdown somewhere in the world can take out the entire industry. So this is why we share best practices and why we have actually two regulators. So what does that really cost or cost? Well, think of it this way. With two regulators breathing down your necks, you are going to do a high-speed shimmy in terms of improving your programs, processes, procedures across the board. Because the minute somebody hears about a best practice over here, INPO is telling the rest of the country, this is how this site is doing it. This is Palo Verde's best process for corrective action programs. We think all of you should take a look at that. So that's exactly what happened across the industry. And so another way in which we really expanded and improved on is the way we solve problems in our very high risk environment. So based on what Lori asked me to talk about, I wanted to talk about how we've incorporated these complex problem solving methodologies on our high risk environments into risk management. And again, the eagerness to learn from our mistakes and be a continuous improvement organization is never as high as it is in the commercial power industry. So we have embraced the latest and greatest, usually as soon as it comes out. And I'll give you some historical perspective here. Quality management systems, total quality management. These tools and techniques were developed back in the 40s and 50s. And we embraced those into commercial nuclear sites in the 60s and 70s. And if you know of Dr. Edward Deming and his work in Japan after World War II, Dr. Deming is revered worldwide for being one of the leaders in total quality management. Well, in my company, when I started out in the 1980s, we were chasing the Deming Prize from Japan, and we won it in 1989. First company in the world outside of Japan to win the Deming Prize. And I actually have a commemorative Deming medal on my desk, because I'm one of the few people in the world that have a Deming medal sitting here for being part of the team. And by the way, my role was to be a root cause subject matter expert. So that's what really kicked all this off. Moving on, we had the fishbone introduced by Dr. Kaoru Ishikawa in the 1940s at Tokyo University. And the fishbone became the first ever visual of cause and effect. And it was wonderful. And a lot of industries have adopted the fishbone from the 40s. And then we married the fishbone with 5Ys, which was developed in the 70s by Toyota. You know, the Toyota production system came into being. It really gained popularity in the 70s here in the United States. The 5Ys became a widespread methodology. And when we married 5Ys and layered it on top of the fishbone, it really became a more powerful tool, still in use to this day, actually, in industries like pharma, healthcare, aerospace, and others. Then in the 80s came the events and causal factors chart methodology, which became the standard, and I used it up until about a decade and a half ago. And I'll remind you that in 1986, Motorola brought us Lean Six Sigma. So think about all these advancements historically, and the nuclear industry has been at the forefront of embracing and adapting, because we are by far one of the best learning organizations in the world in any regulated industry. So the improvements, I wanted to give you this data point because the improvements of this rapid advancements and being a learning organization and continuously looking for ways to improve, the bottom line for us is capacity factor. So capacity factor is simply how much generation are you putting out compared to your overall ability to generate. So in 1980, for example, at Three Mile Island, the national average for the capacity factor of all nuclear plants was only 55%. Meaning they were only operating 55% of the time. The rest of the time they were down and doing repairs because of massive failures in equipments and people related errors, things like that. By 2019, our capacity factors are over 93%. So close to 100% of being operational when needed, which is an astounding number for the industry. So that is in essence the results of all of this. Now, let me flip a switch here, Lori, though, because I think this is where we want to have a more in-depth discussion for our podcast. In the past few decades, though, we have found ourselves in a whole new working environment, right? Think of the advancements in the last few decades in terms of cellular usage, rapid data transfer, the onset of the age of artificial intelligence and machine learning, right? So now we find ourselves in a more complex socio-technical working environment. And once again, we're required to adapt and find new ways of solving problems, especially complex human-centered problems, which I think we want to get into later. Which brings us to, I guess, one of the reasons why Nuala wanted me to come on the show is my team at DLE Technical Services, we have developed this next-generation complex problem-solving methodology. I called it hyper-integrated causal analysis, which is a takeoff on root cause analysis. So we call it HCA instead of RCA. And I'll be happy to talk about that in much more detail. But it is built for today's environment, whereas much of the tools I described were built in a whole different era. Think of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s technology and the era in which these tools and methodologies were built and used. We're in a totally different ballgame now. The landscape has totally changed.
Yeah, listen, thank you, Rob, for that background. That's brilliant. And what I particularly, there's a few points that that really resonate with me there is how you've identified that the becoming the learning organization, that maturity of thought processes and business processes to support that, as well as the competencies that come with building that learning organization. So I think, you know, to Lori's point earlier on, we're only scratching the surface on this really in biopharma at the moment, but this focus on advancing maturity of being at the forefront of implementing and becoming experts in these disciplines is really, really important. And of course, the payback, the capacity factor that you talk about, that's how we have got to get leadership in pharma to realize that. And coming back to Deming, a nice quote from Deming, I'm so jealous you have a medal. I'm that's definitely.
I am too. I was kind of nerding out over here, Rob. That
yeah, absolutely. Really we'd like to see that someday. But you know, Deming, and I think, you know, we're on the other end very often of some of the maturity practices where Deming says, you know, putting out fires is not an improvement of the process. And unfortunately, in our industry, we're still expert firefighters instead of fire prevention officers. And, you know, we've talked about that before. But I really like that concept of having to shift the maturity. And in fact, in more recently, this whole area of maturity development and maturity advancement has become a key topic for the, you know, coming out of the agency FDA and across the regulatory community. In fact, Dr. Janet Woodcock, who's acting commissioner of FDA at the moment, said in a 2020 FDA Voices article that manufacturers with very high reliability, such as your capacity factor at 93%, usually have what's called a mature quality system. And that's where we need to get to, is actually getting people to recognize that their quality management system isn't just a compliance requirement to get them through the next inspection. It's actually a business capability factor, and the payback in terms of value to the business is great. And of course, conversely, where we see those low maturity quality management practices, where they're just meeting those compliance requirements and short-term business objectives, you know, it usually involves a range of reactive actions to maintain any level of forward progress, with failure events and risks and hazardous situations, you know, typically not being well anticipated, as in predicted and prevented. And of course, even when they occur, we're not doing a great job on investigating. So they're not terribly well understood. And as a result of not having that well, you know, good level of understanding, they don't tend to be well investigated. And that's why we tend to see this, you know, high recurrence of deviations. So we're definitely lagging the others in you know, other sectors, and we have a lot to learn. And I guess to close out on this point, you know, we definitely need to do a better job in terms of these reactive investigations to get those, even those ones up to scratch. But we've also got to shift the needle a little bit for our industry to become much more proactive. And in fact, we had a great discussion with one of our previous guests, Val Mulholland, I think it was three episodes ago, on risk-based decision-making, where we talked a lot about the barrier analysis. And I know you and I, Rob, have talked about that both method, yes, where we focus more on developing those prevention controls rather than just focusing on those mitigation efforts, which tend to be the my hair is burning, we need to mitigate the problem. you know, with prevention being at the heart of the work, because you don't hit a 93% capacity factor by just fixing the problems. You have to get out in front of the problems and prevent and predict and use those like you say, those advancing technologies to do that. So Rob, share your thoughts with us on how we can better achieve a better balance on the corrective or reactive actions versus the preventive and proactive actions.
Yes, absolutely. I love to. That's one of my favorite topics, actually, because all of the clients I speak to, I'm strongly urging them to play the game on the proactive preventive side. Stop playing the game on the reactive mitigation side, which means it's too late, it's after the fact. So, and before I dive in, because I really wanted to bring this particular data point out, when I try to emphasize this point to folks, it really helps for them to understand the cost of poor quality and how human-centered problems are crippling industries, and they're not really realizing to what extent. So I have a couple of studies that I usually talk about. One is from McKinsey in the medical devices sector. And what McKinsey found was that the average cost of poor quality in the medical devices sector is, on average per year, $17 to $26 billion. And that's a little number. Let me tell you about the cost of poor software quality in a recent study. And that study was done by the CISQ organization, which is extremely well-known, the Consortium for IT Software Quality. And they do certifications that are widely known and recognized in the United States. Their study found that in 2018, the cost of poor software quality was, are you sitting down, $2.48 trillion.
Oh my goodness.
And simply to fix the cost, software quality problems in that industry was in the magnitude of $480 billion, just to fix problems, not the rest of, anyway. So with that as a lead-in, do you not think we should be motivated to get proactive and stop these issues as opposed to spending the money on fixing them after the fact? So so let me tell you, and I'm glad you brought out the bow tie risk assessment model. I really like that model because it really clearly shows me the left side proactive, the right side reactive. And what we have done very well in commercial nuclear is establish two key things that really help, and those are key performance indicators and the metrics that go with it to keep us within control bands and trending and analysis programs. But what organizations are not doing real well outside of commercial nuclear is tying causal analysis to this proactive side. So let me get into that a little bit. So by doing what we call quick hit investigations, which means 1 or 2 hours to investigate the low, 90% of the issues are low level issues. And we spend a little bit of time and come up with some more in-depth causes of those smaller issues. We can now populate our trending program with really good information, which allows us to then analyze the information and come up with negative trends early on. Once we have a negative trend identified, now we launch into a more formal causal analysis, or HCA. And guess what? We will identify the deepest seated causes of what's driving the issues before they ever get to the point of bypassing all of our defenses and getting us into a more serious, consequential, expensive event, maybe even a fatality. So this is where the game should be played and won, is understanding what's driving our issues at the low level, doing great training and analysis. That means documenting our problems, analyzing our problems, even to a small extent. And I'll give you the biggest drawback to that. The tools that are in place in most places are, for the root cause analysis tools, are all or nothing. It's like, you got to wait for a big event for me to invoke these big tools. And that's no longer the case. That's one of the things that I set out to solve, which means a highly scalable model that lets you tackle the simplest of issues in 1 hour or the most complex of issues in 6 weeks, if that's what it takes. And that did not exist before. So this is what we're driving the industry, a mindset of getting ahead of events, using the causal analysis tools in a meaningful way on the proactive side. Because as you know, you can analyze all of the risk, you can put defenses in place, and they involve largely administrative requirements and some forms of protective equipment and so on. But nothing's perfect. There are latent weaknesses built into those everywhere. And humans have a way of actually finding their way through those weaknesses. And humans are the infinite variable that causes a lot of problems. So human-centered problems is what I've learned in my last couple of decades is what we need to solve. And now marry that with the concept of complex socio-technical systems that we're working in. And that's the modern day equation that we have to be able to solve.
Oh, Rob, thank you so much. This has all been so interesting. I have a couple of points I wanted to kind of touch on that we experience that you talked about, but we experience in pharma is, I think one is I like how you mentioned the complex tools. I think for whatever reason, we just love complexity, right? And so there'll be a very simple, you know, root cause analysis. And we're like, let's just give it our all and get, you know, 20 people in a room and lots of flip charts. And so yes. I think that that scalable approach is something that I think is very much needed. And likewise, I've also been to places where they just use one tool and that's it for everything. Right. So, and it's that's not true. Even complex, you know, it's not complex enough. In terms of the trending and analysis, I think that's something that I also see a struggle quite frequently with, especially in terms of deviations, investigations. We tend to want to solve the issue, but then we don't evaluate over time what's happening in those systems and whether or not our solution was actually effective, right? We tend to have a lot of repeat events, things like that, I think, crop up. And the last thing that I kind of think transitions into that is you talked a lot about prevention actions. And in our CAPA, or Corrective Preventive Action System, it's oftentimes mostly just the CA of the CAPA, if any preventive actions exist at all sometimes.
Agreed.
So I used to joke that we should turn it around and call it the PACA system, the preventive action kappa, corrective action, because maybe it would emphasize that should come first, right? To your point, you know, that's where you should put your money. That's where you should put your energy, right? Because then, of course, that should decrease the corrective action, that back end of that bow tie, if you will, right? So I really appreciate that. And what I want to transition to, because I could go on forever with you probably on just those topics alone. I used to be a quality investigator too, Rob. So that was great.
Okay.
Yeah. So you hit my passion there. And I did nerd out a little bit with the Deming award. I'm not going to lie. That was pretty neat. I hope I get to meet you sometime in person and get to see that.
Super. You bet.
But in terms of something that you touched on a little bit earlier in the conversation today, was these socio-technical problems that we're now facing in today's world in terms of the types of technologies that we're dealing with, that human factor that you talked about a little bit too. Can you tell us a little bit more, go into a little bit more detail about how you're examining these more complex issues and maybe what your approach is to that?
Well, that's a big loaded question. There's so much to talk about. Before I launch into that, though, I do want to briefly comment on PACA versus Kappa, which
let's
I love.
Go. Let's change the world, Rob, and change that acronym.
I'm telling you, this is what's going on. A lot of the management, a lot of the managers in organizations, as soon as an event happens, they take corrective actions, the CA part of it. And then they try to steer the people doing the investigations into sort of concluding and coming up with the causes that actually fit the actions they've already taken. So they don't have to do any more actions. And so the preventive stuff is often lost. So that's one piece. And the other piece of this is they don't really follow the hierarchy of hazard controls. And I'm a big fan of that model. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the hierarchy of hazard controls, at the very top is, hey, let's eliminate the hazard or replace it with something less hazardous, or engineer it out or substitute it or isolate us from the hazard. Those are the ones that work. What is the bottom of the barrel? Let's put more administrative requirements in place. Let's train more people and let's put more PPE requirements in place where people may or may not follow. And Nuala put it to me the other day very well. It's the, what is it? Shame, blame, and retrain game?
Yes.
we're experts at it. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And let's retrain on the thing that we just said we didn't train effectively on the exact same content.
Bingo. So, you know, I push for, look at the top of the food chain in terms of hierarchy of hazards controls, and that's where our focus should be. I'm actually urging all my clients to change their corrective action procedures to adopt that and focus on that first. And it's not as hard as people might think. So anyway, just wanted to throw that out there because that's a you hit on a huge point for me, which is you might do a great job up front and then you fail miserably on the back end by doing horrible corrective action, preventive action. And most of the actions that are currently being done are not preventive. They're simply raising awareness, anyway, let me move on because I could talk for a while on that one. You hit my button there.
Oh, sorry. You hit mine too.
So go back to complex socio-technical systems, okay? So I wish I could draw you a picture, but let me give you this sense. So if you imagine this framework in today's environment, and they have, of course, people in the middle of it all. And within this framework, you have people engaging with infrastructure and engaging with the latest and greatest technology. And you have them working within a culture that is created usually by senior leadership. And you have them working within programs, processes, procedures, and policies. And then you have them working within constraints, things like process measuring tools, goals, metrics, big data, data analytics. That's a complex socio-technical system where humans and technology are together working in this seamless environment. But guess what? The interactions of these social and technical factors create conditions for their successful or unsuccessful organizational performance. So it is this interaction between social and technical factors that create linear and nonlinear cause and effect relationships, and is sometimes even very complex, unpredictable relationships. And I say that because humans are the unpredictable infinite variable. I don't care what you have in place, humans can totally muck things up because they are the unpredictable variable. And when I look at the models that are out there, the methodologies that are trying to get at the deep-seated causes for these human-centered problems, they, in too many cases, invoke a process of elimination, which is I look at the risks and identify these 10, 15 areas that we think the problem lies in, and then we do a process of elimination in however we want, whether troubleshooting or investigation, and we kind of rule out the 14 and we find that it's this 15th one. Humans don't have a finite number of possibilities. They have an infinite number of possibilities. So our methodology has to be able to go in that direction. And in the case of interfacing with things like equipment, which do have finite variability, we also can accommodate that as well. So this is the model that has to exist for today's modern environment and many of the traditional ways that, in fact, from what I hear in pharma, things like five whys and barrier analysis, those are very one-dimensional and are not really built to tackle this complex environment. And I wanted to further expand on human-centric problems because I want to be very, very clear the issues that we have to unravel and identify in today's working environment. So think of it as a bowl of spaghetti. And in this bowl of spaghetti, we're going to find the following. First of all, human behavioral factors. And we focus on at-risk behaviors more than anything, because that's usually what creates our problems. So one of the ingredients in this bowl of spaghetti is human factors that we must be able to analyze. The second one is all of our interfaces with equipment, any kind of materials, and any kind of tooling that is in use. We must evaluate any interfaces that we have with those three, because people might think, well, an equipment failure is just an equipment failure. Not so. Think of it this way. Humans designed the equipment, and then they drew up how it was going to be manufactured. Then humans fabricate the equipment. They manufacture it. They store it. Then they transport it. Then they install it somewhere else. Then we operate it. Then we maintain it. The interaction with humans and equipment is huge and enormous. We must be able to address all of that. And then third is this huge world that we work to, which is called the regulations and the flow down of regulations. And guess what? None of the procedures and programs are perfect. So we have latent organizational and programmatic weaknesses that we must uncover. And usually there's a lot of these latent weaknesses that we uncover when we do these investigations. So these three large factors are jumbled up, and there's multiple instances of these, not one, in this big bowl of spaghetti. And that's what I built ACA to unravel. With ACA, we clearly define exactly how all of these things are causing the ultimate problems that we're facing, whether it's a negative trend or a singular event or a fatality or a major equipment malfunction, whatever it is. This bowl of spaghetti is what's behind it all. And it took me a decade to figure out how to do this a kind of effort, but that is what it takes today in these modern working environments. I hope you got a picture. I wish I had diagrams and stuff to show you. That would be a lot more fun.
No, we absolutely did get a picture. And, you know, something you called out, you and I have spoken about this hierarchy of controls before and how important it is. And actually, I'm working on a tool at the moment around the effectiveness of our risk assessments, being able to score the effectiveness of our risk assessments based on how many of our whether they're preventative controls or mitigating controls. So we can score that. So obviously we'd like to see more prevention than cure. And also, how many of our controls are down at the bottom of the barrel? Are they relying on things like PPE or our environmental controls or our administrative SOP, you know, three signatures or whatever controls? And so we should score those lower than the ones that are looking at substituting or eliminating or engineering controls. And so you're absolutely right. This is something that, you know, once we've filled in the boxes, we think we've got the job done, rather than really looking at, you know, trying to advance the effectiveness of our risk assessments. And, you know, one of the other things that comes to mind with this bowl of spaghetti And of course, the people in the room that are doing the evaluations is, you know, that we, and we've talked about this in the last two episodes about, you know, groups and groupthink and the impact of biases. When you mentioned there, Rob, you know, leaders have already come up with the plan of what they're going to correct. And then you need to fill the paperwork in retrospectively to fit the cause. And you know, it reminds me of a book that I love by Cass Sunstein and Reed Hasty. It came out a couple of years ago. It's called Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink and How to Make Groups Smarter. And one of the things that they talk about that's really important, they have lots of great ideas about how to make groups smarter, but one of the things that they talk about, particularly in these complex problem-solving environments, and particularly when we've got this bowl of spaghetti that we're trying to approach, is that it's really important to segregate the issue or opportunity identification phase of the work from the solution selection phase or evaluation phase of the work. And I know that Laurie and I have talked about this before, that much of our, you know, many of our risk assessment tools or our risk assessment practices drive this 20 people into a room and we have to get from the left-hand side of the spreadsheet to the right-hand side. Uh-huh. And, yes. And but the point that Sunstein and Hasty make is that, you know, really these two activities of identification and solution building are really require different skills like creativity for that, you know, identification, issue identification or risk identification or opportunity if we're looking at it from a continuous improvement perspective. That really requires that more creative, less critical, open-minded approach where everything goes, get it up there, let's evaluate it later. Whereas then we can't expect people to do a quick shimmy and a mind shift right there. And then we should close that, if, you know, rank them or something, and then come back and get the group or another group together who are better at looking at that kind of solution or decision-making activities, where you're winnowing down from the expanded list and you're zeroing in on those good nuggets or good solutions, as Sunstein and Hasty say. So what do you think, is that part of your process, Rob, this two-step concept, is that part of it?
Oh, without a doubt. I couldn't agree more with Sunstein and Hasty on this particular topic. So they are completely distinct efforts. And they should be treated as completely different efforts, maybe even different groups of people doing it. Although I often get asked to participate in the latter, the solution part, because I think the skills, and you hit it on the head, the skills that are required are very much different. So on the left side, if you will, on the evaluation, I've really honed in on what is actually required. And among those, the most important in my book is critical thinking. And so I have built the foundation for HCA in critical thinking. And we can expand on that a little bit later. But with critical thinking, and I've defined it in very clear terms, we get to understand the best questions to ask, which, as you know, and folks like Einstein famously said, it is in asking the best questions that we're going to get the answer. So if I had 1 hour to live and I had a problem to solve, I would spend 55 minutes figuring out the right questions to ask. That's what HCA is built on. Critical thinking, generating the best possible lines of inquiry, and then the solutions, not the solutions, the causes are going to fall out. So now having the best, deepest-seated causes to actually address gives us a huge leg up in getting the right corrective actions that actually prevent recurrence. Let me give you the nuance as to the major fallacy. The methodologies that we're using today stop too soon. They stop halfway because we're living with a definition that says, identify the root causes for this event. Sounds logical. It's been in place for 5-6 decades, except that in my practice, come to find out that the root causes for this event are not the deepest seated causes. The deepest seated causes, you got to keep analyzing past the root causes for the one event to get to the real deepest seated causes, which will, of course, explain this event, but many, many others. So guess what industries, including commercial nuclear, have been doing for decades? They stopped too soon. They're not getting to the real issues, and the corrective actions are doomed not to prevent recurrence. So I talked to a hospital administrator in Maine who runs seven hospitals, and they told me, we've done 15 million root causes in healthcare, but the rate of patient incidence has not gone down. What does that tell you? They're not really going deep enough. They're not really identifying it. So having said all that, that sets the stage for why, that explains for why we're not doing a really good job of finding the real issues to solve, which of course sets us up for failure. But in addition to that, a lot of things are going on here on the right side, which is management wants to be able to control and afford from a budgetary standpoint, what needs to be done. And oftentimes those budgetary constraints play a factor, and other sort of agendas play factors. And there's lots of agendas why we want to constrain the corrective actions, whether it be legal issues, legal ramifications, and other things like that. So we have an issue here. So on the right-hand side of the equation, I subscribe to really using something like design thinking, for example, where you can really generate, ideate, iterate your way to fantastic solutions very quickly. So if your audience hasn't been exposed to design thinking, I suggest they go see my friend, Sherry, Dr. Jevedin, who has a genius lab that applies design thinking on the solution half of the equation. So there's lots of things over here that can be done to improve the value, the effectiveness of corrective actions, but this is still worthless unless the front end, the identification of the real deep-seated causes, is actually done well. So again, this is where ACA goes, that extra step, and we go past the point where you just identify the event root causes. And I certainly have several examples of that that I can relate to you later, but hopefully that gives you where I stand on this two-part approach. I completely agree with it, and they do require different sets of skills.
Thank you, Rob. Again, very interesting. And I was going to say a side note, I'm going to quote you in the future to say humans can muck things up. That's going to be my new quote from Rob, because I totally agree with you. I used to, when you talk about those risk controls, we prioritize those engineering controls a lot of times to try to remove that human interface. The challenge is exactly what you pointed out. Those automated controls are designed by humans. So it's kind of ironic, right? A lot of times we still end up with problems, even though we're trying to shoot for this, you know, the highest point for those controls. We want to transition topics a little bit now and focus, focus more on that critical thinking and complex problem solving piece that you've been talking about throughout today. And kind of talk about a little bit about the education behind that. So we're seeing a struggle, I think, in pharma in terms of how do we sort of teach that, educate people how to practice that. And I want to step back a little bit in time of history of at least the U.S. education system anyway. In terms of, I did a presentation with a colleague of mine, Monica Cahilly, and we talked through a little bit about critical thinking and complex problem solving just at the end of last year. And something I hadn't really realized through listening to her presentation, and it really kind of opened my eyes to why we struggle sometimes with this, I think, is if you look back at the U.S. education system, we really were taught rote memorization sort of culturally several decades ago. It was don't challenge authority. You know, you do what people tell you to do. You stay in your job for 20, 30, 40 years, maybe even at the same company. And one of the things we were evaluating was how that kind of stripped people or humans of that sort of capability to critically think because, hey, the teacher said this, so I do that, right? And so then when that translates into my job of boss said to do this, so I do exactly what the boss says. I don't challenge the status quo, just keep going. And I've seen a transition with that of my own kids who are teenagers now where they're actually taught to debate common topics that are rather accepted in the United States. And they're now asked, you know, debate that, which debate both sides of that topic. And that, I think that forces a little bit of that critical thinking and problem solving. So I think we're seeing a transition in the younger generation. Then there's my generation sort of trapped in the middle, right? We were sort of taught with that rote memorization piece, maybe a little bit of challenge. Maybe we do challenge a little bit in the workplace, but we're sort of caught in the middle. So I think that's a place we're struggling on. How do we encourage people to really dig into topics like you just talked about, to get deep into that root cause analysis, to really critically think through that? What are your needs? What are your thoughts, Rob, in terms of needs around that critical thinking skills development?
Oh boy, did you open up Pandora's box? Because this is my favorite topic.
Good.
So I'll start by, first of all, completely agreeing with your initial remarks regarding the education system. Could not agree more wholeheartedly. I'll tell you this. So last September, October, I wrote a paper on critical thinking that was picked up by the 40th International Conference on Critical Thinking and presented at the conference. And then I had to defend it in two sessions, much like this, to an international audience. That was a lot of fun. That paper, the main point of that paper was to say that our education system has failed us. And I cite study after study after study, studies done at the grade school level and at the university level, that and others, some studies show that 50% of millennials get an F in critical thinking. And the two studies came to that same conclusion. So I'm very critical of mainstream education because they teach to the lowest common denominator, right? Standardized testing. And they do focus quite a bit on STEM. This is a nuance, by the way. They focus on STEM, which is fantastic, but they don't focus enough on how to solve human-centric issues. Point in case, I have a master's level education in nuclear engineering. I come on board a nuclear submarine. I started my career as a nuclear submarine officer, and I am the reactor supervisor. So you'd think, hey, I'm well-armed, well-educated. Well, I never had to use math or physics or any of the sciences to solve all of the problems I ran into in a nuclear submarine. They were all human-centered problems, and I was completely disarmed because our education system failed us there. They don't teach critical thinking that goes into solving human-centered problems. So huge gaps. And so I agree with you, and I actually went on record on that. So the other piece is, and I love where you took this, by the way, what do we need to learn? What do we need to teach? So I spoke to a university professor from the United Kingdom, as it turns out, and he was developing a curriculum for critical thinking for the university. And 2 years later, he could not finish. He could not get it across the goal line because they could not agree on what the content needed to be. Because, again, some of the research shows that there are as many theories on critical thinking and what it is as there are theorists. So it is all over the place. And some people think it's just something in the clouds that we can never achieve. We can just hope to get better at critical thinking. And those are the theorists. And then there's the practitioners who are more like me who, well, I have to be able to do it. I need to do it so I can solve problems. So I set about a decade ago to face this challenge because I recognized that we needed to make critical thinking the foundation for complex problem solving. So I actually defined critical thinking in very clear terms, and this is how I teach it. Critical thinking is the intellectually disciplined process for gathering, organizing, and analyzing information so that you can make the best decisions or take the best course of action. And we break down specifically, what does it mean to gather information? From where? What are your sources? How do you validate those? What does it mean to organize your information? Well, we have tables, we have Pareto charts, process maps, fault trees, affinity diagrams. We have lots of tools that you readily recognize that we can organize the information so that we can do various types of analyses. And I break them down into three types. You have data analysis for quantifiable data, and they include control charts and Pareto analysis and things like that. You have the process of elimination analysis, right? Which is like a fault tree methodology. Where, hey, we have to predefine these are the possible risks, and we do things like failure modes and effect analysis or error modes and effect analysis. So those are the kinds of data analysis that that we need to do up front. And then we can get to causal analysis. Causal analysis is the big one. That's where we actually identify the deepest seated causes using whatever advanced methodologies we have at our disposals, like HCA, for example. So now when you have solved the problem, these are the deepest issues to be solved. Now you can take the best action, put in place great corrective action and preventive action, or make decisions. And I'll give you a simple critical thinking exercise. Go buy a house, get the information from the multiple listing service and put it in a table. And in the table, you have, these are my houses, these are my square footage, dollar per square foot, what residence they're in, does it have waterfront? And you feed all the information into a table, and then you grade the houses one against the other based on your criteria, and you come up with a scoring system for all these elements. That's critical thinking. And now you base your decision on which house best met your needs, right? So that's a very straightforward approach to critical thinking. Gather information, organize it in a way that you can analyze it, and then make your decision. If we can learn to do that as a society, it'd be incredible, but we don't teach it. So one of the things that I wanted to bring up was, I'm actually working with a group of teachers and parents here locally and the Education Foundation to develop a curriculum that we can, for a curriculum for parents to teach their children how to think more critically. Because here's my point. We should be teaching critical thinking at the grade school level.
Yeah.
And all the grades up through high school and into college. And I don't mean the theoretical aspects. I mean the practical application of critical thinking. Define it in simple terms. Tell them how to do it. Let them practice it. So this is something I want to do on a not-for-profit side, to let all parents take this course so they can then in turn teach your children. It's one of the things we need to do for our society. Now, I just want to bring this point home in a big way. You're familiar with the World Economic Forum. These are the CEOs from all over the world. They meet once a year. In the 2016 World Economic Forum, they put out a 160-page report called the Future of Jobs Report. And one of the things they put out was the top 10 human skills needed to thrive in the age of artificial intelligence. Where do you think the top three skills are? This is going to blow your mind. Number three, creativity. Number two, critical thinking. Number one, complex problem solving. Those are the top three skills that world leaders believe we need to thrive in this upcoming age of machine learning and artificial intelligence, yet our education system is nowhere near in reinforcing those. Is that amazing?
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely, Rob. And I think you're so right. Grade school and up. And there's so much helicopter parenting going on that, you know, it's a wonder we even let them think for themselves, never mind critically think at this stage. but look, we've covered so much ground there. And I think, you know, just to get towards wrapping towards the end, it would be great if you would just give us a little bit of, you've talked a lot about the critical thinking and the complex problem solving, but just the actual techniques around this next generation HCA process. And what are the key differentiators? You hit on a little bit of it earlier on that we stop too soon, or we're treating some of the symptoms, not the deepest seated causes. So what are those key differentiators from the, you know, the traditional root cause processes that we're still using in our industry?
Well, and again, I wish I had a diagram to be able to show you a picture, because a picture is so powerful. So I'm going to try to paint a picture for you. Okay, so hyperintegrated causal analysis, by definition, integrates a lot of the things that used to be done separately, independently. So right off the bat, we've taken some very traditional tools and methods that you readily recognize. So let's start with barrier analysis, which we do every time. A barrier analysis is essential because you have to evaluate the things that were in place that should have prevented these events. So they include the programs, processes, procedures, requirements, and also physical barriers such as lead shielding, right, to prevent against radiation, or fire doors and fire dampers, or engineer safety features. So whatever these barriers are, a lot of them failed to allow these events to happen. So we're going to evaluate the barriers. So that's one thing that's integral to HCA. Then we also integrate comparative timeline analysis, task analysis, change analysis. All these are done simultaneously now, not individually in tables. The table methodologies for like barrier analysis and these others are very ineffective, and they all stop at the first or second level symptom. those are merely starting points for us, because these initial analyses that we're doing in an integrated fashion, and they include data analysis that we've integrated, for example, Pareto charts for quantifiable data, the insights of those become part of our upfront phase one analysis. Everything I'm describing is phase one. Process mapping to get insights into where the processes are failing, right? Affinity diagrams so we can identify emerging themes from pockets of failures. All these things are done upfront in an integrated fashion. And the whole purpose of an HCA phase one effort is to generate what Einstein famously said, the best possible lines of inquiry. So we're looking like a doctor would. Think of yourself as a doctor. What do you do when you get a sick patient? You look at all the symptoms. You look for all the symptoms. So by looking at, this is what should have happened. These were the requirements. This is all the evidence we have gathered and all the data we have gathered and analyzed. And we're looking for the irregularities, the differences between what happened and what should have happened. And it is these symptoms, these irregularities, that are going to generate our lines of inquiry. Now, phase one is complete with a fantastic set of lines of inquiry that are very focused on the issues that are the manifestation of this problem or this negative trend or this individual event. All of that is phase one. Now we go into phase two, which is causal analysis. And let me say this for those folks who are using some kind of methodology out there. If you didn't do cause and effect analysis, you didn't do causal analysis. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, but there's some traditional tools out there that they're using that are not cause and effect, yet they call it a root cause analysis. So let's throw that out there. Now we get into the basic building block of cause and effect analysis is the five whys. But to do any kind of a serious effort requires 30, 40, 50 lines of inquiry, i.e. 40, 50 separate five whys. So that's integrated into this. And that's important because some folks are trying to do a root cause with two or three five whys and call it a cause tree. And that's nowhere near the right level of rigor. The other piece is we've learned to look for common causes. By definition, the root, the deepest seated causes are the common factor to a lot of problems. Therefore, for our purposes, we must be looking for common causes, and we are designed and built and trained folks to do that, to look for common causes and then keep going in the evaluation till we get to the deepest seated causes, which are actionable within our control. So you can't go to the Earth's gravitational pull or the congressional budget. If you do that, you went too far and your company's going to shoot you because they can't fix those things. So there is a limit to how deep you can go. But if you get to that rock bottom, deepest seated cause, just on the hairy edge of your control, you're there, right? And if you've just fixed something for that one event, well, there's so many infinite other variabilities that could cause other numbers of events that you're just doomed. And I think that's what I see in regulated industries, the constant recurrence of failures caused by complex human-centric problems where we're not getting to the real deepest seated causes. So hopefully that created a picture of our phase one, phase two approach, which is phase one completely built on critical thinking, the gathering, organizing, and analyzing of evidence so we can generate great questions and think about how we can translate that to grade schools, teach our kids. Kids, the key to this is to understand, right? Gather enough information to understand and then ask really pointed, great questions so you further understand. And then if we could possibly teach them how to ask follow-up questions to get to the bottom of the issue, we've got critical thinkers and we got problem solvers. And my God, what a generation we would build if that's the case.
But you can't test to that, though, Rob, on a standardized test.
I know that standardized testing is crippling our country.
I just wanted to poke the bear on that one, Rob. you've also given me confidence that my summer project that I gave to my two teens about trying to figure out how they're going to afford to live in a local apartment and evaluate living expenses and such, that's what I gave them as their project. And they're very excited because they assume they're going to outsmart me, that It's actually cheaper to live on their own than they think it is. So anyway, so thank you for that. And I did want to point out something. I loved how you talked about the common causes, because I think another failure that we experience, not to open the Pandora's box again about PACA, but I think sometimes we do find a lot of really great causes that, you know, span a lot of issues, to your point, but then we create a corrective action for that one little tiny area. And right. And we don't do that preventive action for the rest of the bigger picture. And the last thing I was going to say is I just wanted to add to your list of tools you've been talking about. One of my favorite ones, and I think you touched on it briefly, is fault tree analysis. I absolutely love that tool. And unfortunately, I wasn't taught it as an investigator, which is criminal. I think every QA investigator should have that tool in their toolbox. But I was wondering if you could expand on what you just talked about and give us a couple of examples, maybe around, you know, a large problem, a small problem, where you've used this HCA process and tell us how that was scalable then.
Oh, super. Great. How about if I start with a fault tree example?
I would like that.
Very cool. I've got some great examples. One was the explosion at the Idaho National Laboratory's breeder reactor, 40-foot fireball. It singed the side of the containment structure. The diameter of the burn mark was 80 feet in diameter. It was a crazy thing. And we had a world-renowned scientist, Dr. Bob Iotti was the chemist that came to evaluate what caused the reaction that caused the explosion. And I was the root cause analyst for this team. And we had metallurgists and engineers and PhDs, and of course, the Department of Energy government on the team looking over our shoulder. And in order for them to really dissect the problem, I had them create fault trees. So we created 7 fault trees for all 7 possible types of reactions or possible types of incidents that could have caused the explosion, because they were going on just by what Dr. Balbiotti was saying, which is, I think it was this chemical reaction. And they wanted to say, okay, we're done. Bob said, this is it, we're done. I said, well, hang on. A junior scientist sitting in DOE headquarters can sit here and second guess us till doomsday with 3 other possible credible chemical reactions. So we need to evaluate them all. How do we do that? We're going to build fault trees, folks. Now, I don't know anything about these chemical reactions, but I know how to build fault trees. So I guided the scientists and engineers through the fault trees. We created 7, and then we sent out people with work orders in hand to the power plant to do troubleshooting and et cetera. And we ruled out everything. And in the end, Dr. Balbiotti was right. It was this particular chemical reaction. And then they said, we're leaving. We're done. This is great. I said, no, that was just phase 1 data analysis. Now we got to find out how those faults came to be. We need to do causal now. And I wanted to highlight that because that's a huge failure of a lot of companies. They stop as soon as they identify that failure mode for whatever happened, and they don't go deeper than that. A second great example of that is I was sent to a chemical weapons plant which destroys sarin gas and mustard gas. This is an Army depot. And they had 7 consecutive motor failures of their air compressor motors over the span of 11 months. And every time one failed, they'd put a new one in or a refurbished one, and it would fail within hours. It would destroy itself. The bearings would wipe out and the shaft would destroy itself. So the Army got tired of watching these 7 failures and said, stop, go get somebody from the outside. So I went to the chemical depot. And again, phase 1, understand the failure modes. And it wasn't 1, it was 7. So first we did a huge fault tree of these motors with the vendors who manufacture the motors and the SMEs, clearly identified the 7 failure modes. And again, they thought, this is great, let's go fix these. And I said, okay, but now we go to phase 2. How did these 7 failure modes came to be? These are the deepest seated, latent organizational and programmatic issues that are generating these and others. And we did that. Now, to show you the efficiency of HCA, on average, these incidents, these event investigations would take us 3 to 6 months with 12 or 20 people to get something this detailed done. That is the industry consensus on these type of efforts. Our phase 1 for both the breeder reactor and this chemical weapons plant took 1 week, and our phase 2 took 1 week. And the teams were pretty compact. So we're doing in 2 weeks what would take a traditional methodology months to do the same. And in many cases, they will not be as effective in getting to the real issues. So there's some pretty heavy hitting type issues. And now I want to share with you a little one, which is really a fun one. So I'm at Pantex, the nuclear weapons plant, where they actually assemble and store the final products, the final nuclear weapons. And in this building where they store the weapons, there was a tool crib. And the tool crib attendant caused a fire. And it was a terrible thing. Imagine a fire inside a building full of nuclear weapons. And the fire marshal came and said, okay, the cause of the fire is this battery was plugged in backwards and it overheated and it caused a flame and the room caught fire. If it wasn't for a couple of folks nearby that dumped a fire extinguisher, we'd be in serious in the hurt locker, right? So I happened to be there and they thought it was a case closed. You know, it was the tool crib attendant made a mistake, miswired the battery charger, causing the fire, et cetera. We're done. And because I was on site that week, just out of coincidence, management said, why don't we throw this on an HCA and see what happens? So we took all of the information, put it on a chart, and we sent people out to gather the initial set of information and data, right? Well, within 24 hours now, they came back and said, here's what we know. And from our sessions with the folks, here's what happened. It was a stand-in tool crib attendant that was never trained to be one. It was just somebody doing a favor for the actual attendant. The batteries and the wiring that were there in the room were completely mislabeled, mismarked. They were thrown around very haphazardly. There was no control over these battery chargers and their wiring. The battery section was not segregated from the rest like they were supposed to. There were flammable, combustible materials right next to these batteries, which is not allowed. And secondly, there was too many combustibles in the room, which is, again, not allowed. So we're uncovering all these latent weaknesses of the processes and how that tool crib attendant was actually set up to fail with no instructions how to operate this battery charger, et cetera, and the markings. And the whole thing was just a disaster. And that was not the best part. During the timeline that we established to analyze what happened and what should have happened, when the folks that discovered the fire pulled the alarm station, it did not work. So what do I call that? We call it an equipment interface issue. So we put that down on a chart. Follow through on this equipment interface issue. So we found the preventive maintenance, the annual PM, done on the fire pull stations across the whole site, all the buildings, and determined that the vendor who was doing the annual PMs was falsifying records and not testing one third of all the fire stations, because we chased down the relay station where the relays changed state to verify that they actually did what they say they did. So we went and did the analysis right down to how the relays changed state to validate what was going on. So wow. The huge issue was we had a fire in a nuclear weapons building, and we could not evacuate people fast enough because the alarm stations weren't working. Think of the incredible situation that there happened to be someone and they happened to dump a fire extinguisher and put out the fire very quickly versus the fire went uncontrollably for hours. It spread through the building, major, and we couldn't evacuate people because the alarm stations weren't. That was the level of significance that we found by throwing things in an HCA, and all of that was uncovered in 24 hours. So
wow,
that dramatic effectiveness.
Well, what's even more amazing about that is how much bigger it could have been. Those are the stories I think that we need to get out there more, is where those things could have been way worse too. Thankfully, yeah. You know, you have this short-term band-aid that somebody happened to put in place, right? Yeah, that's amazing.
So oftentimes I find that the very quick solution is to blame someone, right, Nula? We're going to blame the tool crib attendant.
And then shame
them. Blame and retrain.
We need to retrain her. She obviously wasn't trained for this right. Assistant, yeah. Right? Yeah. So it's horrible the way we're doing business. We quickly jump to the nearest thing and we put a procedure in place or put another warning sign on the door, something administrative that does absolutely nothing. Here's the funniest part. I have to wrap it up with this. The tool crib attendant, the actual attendant who owns the tool crib, is a lady. And when this happened and she came in to talk to us, she said, they burned down my she shed. That's my she shed. So it was famously called the fire in the she shed incident. That's how we labeled the investigation.
That's funny. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, both awesome examples and things we could totally learn from, because especially that second one could have been even much more disastrous. So I heard a rumor that you and Nuala are working together on something. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, Nuala?
Yeah, we're really excited. I mean, we were connected. This goes to the network. We were connected through a third party. I had written an article, and Rob had read it, and next thing you know, we're talking, and now we've just written an article together for BioPharm International. That's going to be in the show notes. We'll talk about that in a minute, but we're super excited about the prospect of developing online e-learning program together to address this whole area of critical thinking and complex problem solving, to support the more effective risk-based decision making, which we've been talking about for weeks here. And we're really excited about working together. We definitely found that even though we have come from two completely separate industries, there's so much of our thought practices and our thought processes and our practices have come together, and the work that I do around culture as well and leadership. So, we're really excited. So watch this space. We'll keep you posted. But we're I love the idea of best practice sharing and learning from other sectors. And Rob's got a lot to teach. So we'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah. Thank you. So this has been amazing for me today. I took copious notes, Rob, actually, from this conversation, and I may reach out to you about your comments regarding the learning organization as well. I think that's a whole other topic we could discuss offline too. Any last thoughts regarding critical thinking and complex problem solving from the panel today?
Rob, well, do you have anything?
I'll go first, Nuala. First of all, I want to say that I'm looking forward to collaborating with Nuala. I've read her work, and it drew me to her. So I'm excited that she agreed to collaborate with me on a number of projects. So I wanted to say that real quick. I want to say this. The foundation for critical thinking is learning to gather, organize, analyze information, and ask great questions. And I think that can be taught to kindergartners. And we need to be moving in that direction. So I really strongly recommend that. And the foundation for complex problem solving is critical thinking. So I want to make sure folks walk away with that sentiment and the importance of it, and the fact that we're not going to rely on our education system. We need to do it ourselves. We need to self-educate, because we're not going to get these from the standardized testing approach that the United States has taken. I don't know about other countries, but we're certainly teaching to a low common denominator. So we need to take it upon ourselves to teach the next generation critical thinking and complex problem solving, which are the two most important human skills that they're going to need in the age of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and from my perspective, Lori, I mean, there's so much. I'm the same. I've been scribbling notes all afternoon here, and I think we've blown the budget for the Voices in Validation time budget. We've completely blown the.
I think the budget. Yeah, Stacey's like, forget it.
Yeah, sorry about that, Stacey. You get three nerds in a room together, in a Zoom room together, and you're done for. But you know, I think some of the stuff that for me, the big takeaway is that we stop too early. The tools that we're using, we stop too early. We get to the point where we've identified the failure mode, but we don't look at the causes. We're not doing that cause and analysis, and we're not going deep enough. And I think that, for me, is the big takeaway, that we, you know, we're just happy to stick the Band-Aid to get to that point. So there's so much. We're going to have you back for another episode at some point in the future, Rob. But great show, and really enjoyed it. So Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no, thank you. Sure. Amazing, amazing discussion. Yeah.
Thank you all. My pleasure being here.
Yeah. So back to our key takeaways. We always have some takeaways from our and for the show notes to keep. Stacey keeps us working to make sure that we don't just chat, that we have to supply some collateral for our listeners as well. So this week, obviously, what we're going to include is the BioPharm International May 2021 article that Rob and I have collaborated on. There's also an ISPE PDA root cause analysis tools guide that I was a member of the team a couple of years ago, 2019, where ISP and PDA collaborated together. And it's a nice little guide. And you know, it talks to the point that Laurie said earlier on, you know, that she's been in organizations, they're only using one tool. So this is just, you know, it talks about simple, medium and complex, not quite HCA, but even to get to that point. There's also a lovely article that Laurie pointed to, which was Article of the Year for ISP a couple of years ago. And that's how to choose a risk management tool. And it's got some nice little tool choice charts in there. And last but not least, our colleague Jim Vesper did a podcast on root cause analysis with the JVT Network not so long ago. So we'll include that link in the show notes as well, Stacey. Yeah.
Fantastic. We've got them all. Yeah. So many great takeaways, plus so many points, thought-provoking points from this episode. Definitely five star. So we'll, you know, have a lot of, and we invite our listeners to provide some feedback on it too, as they are listening. But I want to say thank you again to our Risk Revolution leaders, Lori and Nuala, as always, amazing. Thank you again as well to Rob for sharing your expertise, very much appreciated. And I also want to give a shout out to our producer, Ben Kitchen. And lastly, our humble appreciation to you, our valued listeners. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to subscribe in your podcast player of choice. And don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, and online networks. If you have topic requests or guest suggestions, we'd also love to hear from you about that. For today's show notes and links to all of those great takeaways that Nuala just mentioned, please visit www.ivtnetwork.com. And we'll be back again next week with another engaging and entertaining discussion. Until then, make it a great week.